Thank you very much. I actually have some handouts, and there'll be a final exam at the end of the class. So, as Mike says, that okay, thanks. In regions of phase boundaries of systems that are of interest to this program, there's often a region where things are messy and you don't understand what's going on, so you call it a spin glass. So I thought it would, I guess Mike thought it would be useful if to have some discussion of what a spin glass really is and how you know when you've got one. So that is really the idea of this talk. That's what I will try to do. So the a few broad features of the system, and many microscopic details don't seem to matter very much. There's quite a lot of universality, and what is seems to be important, that first of all you need to have disorder. But weak disorder won't give you a spin mass. You need disorder that's sufficiently strong that you also have frustration or competition between different interactions, so that, for example, determining the ground state is itself a non-trivial problem because of the frustration. Well, there are quite a number of systems which have these basic ingredients, and I will illustrate two which are somewhat different. So we start with copper. Metal and put in a small concentration of a of a magnetic element like manganese, and we might put some X percent, X might be something of order 1%. So the manganese are fairly dilute, and it's assumed they go down in some random locations, and the manganese interacts with an RKKY interaction. So the interaction JIJ between two manganese atoms, a distance RIJ apart, this interaction is mediated by the conduction electrons, and because of the discontinuity in the occupancy at the Fermi surface, the interaction oscillates in sign with this period 2kF coming from that discontinuity. And the discontinuity also gives a fairly long-range nature to the interaction, falling off like 1 over R cubed. So you can see that if I put down the manganese in some random locations, obviously there's disorder. But in addition, the sign of the interaction is essentially random too, and so you'll have frustration in the system. If you have randomly positive interactions and negative interactions, you're certainly going to get competition or frustration. So this, of course, is a metal. In this particular case where I chose manganese, it's an S-state ion, relatively little anisotropy. It should be fairly well described by a Heisenberg model, and the interactions are somewhat long range. I don't want to overemphasize that 1 over R cubed. It's certainly not just nearest neighbor. And to illustrate that many of these details don't matter, my second example will be rather different. It will be iron, roughly 0.5, manganese, about 0.5, titanate. This has also been quite extensively studied. And it's not a metal, it's an insulator. So the interactions will be pretty short range. There's quite a lot of anisotropy. This is a layered structure. I think there are hexagonal layers. There's quite a lot of anisotropy, so the spins align in a particular direction, which is perpendicular to the layers. So you would expect it to be better described by an Ising model rather than a Heisenberg model. There is frustration in this. Well, first of all, there's disorder because the iron and manganese go down at random. There's also frustration because the iron-iron interaction is ferromagnetic, and the manganese-manganese interaction is antiferromagnetic, so you have those two different signs. I'm not sure whether the iron-manganese interaction is well characterized, but the iron-iron and manganese-manganese are well characterized because you can create the pure crystals with those in.
Is this a modest layer? I mean, same reason other transition metal oxides are insulators?
I presume it, since it's a transition metal oxide, that it's a not insulator, but I'm not very good at periodic tables and counting electrons in my head. I think you're right. Well, this is two rather different systems, but with rather similar behavior, which I'll go on to describe in a minute. There are many others, and also some of the interest in the field of spin masses has been because spin mass ideas have been argued to be useful in other areas, like protein folding and optimization in computer science and so on. But I'm going to stay away from that and just stick to spin masses. So I said that the behavior is fairly universal as long as you have randomness and frustration. So what is this behavior? So you should look at the first page of the handout. I presume, although it's a Blackboard talk, I can show data. I'm hoping that on the overhead. I'm hoping that's not violating
something
the...
Something we don't encourage.
We don't? But it's difficult to talk about the beta without showing it.
Does this thing automatically stop?
Yes. It doesn't go through the floor. I tried that before.
After last experience, you...
So this is the so the first thing that people measure is generally the AC susceptibility. That's a pretty simple measurement, and this is an example of some work by the Uppsala group on this iron manganese titanate system. And at high temperatures, the data is very reproducible, but as you go to lower temperatures, you get a very sharp turn down, which people call a cusp. Of course, it's always a little bit rounded. And the position and height of this cusp depends on frequency. And this is a range of frequencies between about 5,000 hertz, which is the low one, to 0.05 hertz, which is the top one. So this illustrates that it really need to work at pretty low frequencies to probe what is going on in a spin mass. You need a wide range, you need several decades, this is five decades, and those decades should be at low frequencies. So if you're probing with muons or neutrons, that's probably too fast to really give you a good idea as to whether you have a spin mass or not. Now, so you get this cusp, and the position temperature of the cusp varies somewhat with frequency. And so an important question is whether this just indicates that dynamics get slow as you lower the temperature, but maybe perhaps that's all that happens, or whether there's more to it than that, and that this slow dynamics is an indication of an underlying phase transition. And there was quite a lot of controversy about that, and it seems clear that there is behind this an underlying sharp thermodynamic phase transition. Now, if you have really good data and many decades, you can really extract that actually from the frequency dependence of these cusps in the AC susceptibility. Because you would expect that if there is a critical temperature TC with critical exponents nu for the correlation length and Z for the dynamical exponent, that as omega goes to zero, the cusp temperatures, TC of omega, should approach the actual transition temperature with some power of omega. And this is what the Uppsala group claimed they could fit this data to, with Z nu very large, about 11. The 1 over Z nu is pretty small, so you're only getting a rather small effect as you lower the frequency even through five decades. So to see that there's a sharp spin mass phase transition, you really need to work very hard to get good data for the AC susceptibility. But apparently, you can do it if you work hard enough. So that's one measurement that's often done. But the real clincher for indicating it isn't just flow dynamics, but there's really a phase transition, is the nonlinear susceptibility. This is what I'm calling here the smoking gun for spinless behavior. This is whereas the previous experiment was on this insulating Ising system, these measurements, due to the Grenoble group, Amari et al., quite old measurements, on 1% manganese copper, these are these RKKY spinlasses and should be pretty close to a Heisenberg model being manganese. And what they call here, so that the horizontal axis is of course temperature, and basically A1 is the linear susceptibility and A3 is the nonlinear susceptibility, and A5 is a higher order nonlinear susceptibility, and A3 is the nonlinear is also presented in the box. And the reason I like this paper is that they were kind to theorists and that they factored out all this stuff with dimensions like Bohr magnetons and Boltzmann's constant and presented the data in dimensionless units. So at high temperatures, the nonlinear susceptibility in these units would be 1. And what you see is that it's going up to something like, this is a logarithmic scale, about 1,000 in the vicinity of where presumably the transition temperature is. There's a huge collective effect going on here beyond any reasonable doubt. And if you try to fit this, you indeed find a divergence. That the nonlinear susceptibility diverges at the transition temperature Tc with some critical exponent gamma, which here is around 3, a bit bigger than 3. So this is really quite striking evidence that what you're seeing is not a gradual freezing, but is a sharp phase transition. So when people say, well, we've seen this spin glass in the cuprates or something, I would like to see this sort of data to be convinced that it's really a spin glass. Of course, it's not easy to do. You need the non-linear susceptibility, but it is feasible.
Does the sign always take the same, opposite to the...
Yeah, I think so, because eventually, presumably if you have a really big field, the magnetization is going to saturate. So it's, I think, fairly natural it would bend over with a negative sign. That's right.
Peter, isn't yes. There some ambiguity because TC isn't really known unless you have measured the susceptibility over huge frequency ranges, as you just pointed out previously.
Well, you can... If you want to extract critical exponents, you can use TC as a fit parameter for the nonlinear susceptibility data itself. And in any case, even apart from that, you just look at the data that comes out, you see there's a 1,000-fold increase in the strength of the nonlinear signal. Surely that's very big collective effects, and one could maybe discuss whether there's really a divergence or not. But I think there's clearly very big collective effects going on.
A5 is
that's the coefficient of h to the fifth, and that's predicted to diverge even more strongly.
And it does.
And it does, yes.
It's a static susceptibility.
Yes, this is a static nonlinear susceptibility. So what we're doing here is we're coming down from high temperatures towards the non-putative spinless transition temperature where the dynamics is fairly fast and we can get to equilibrium. And yes, this is the static susceptibility. I should perhaps mention that one technique for getting the nonlinear susceptibility, though, is to apply the field you apply oscillating at some low frequency omega, and then you look at the third harmonic. That's another technique, and that way you've automatically factored out, separated out the linear term. But basically, it's DC. And at low temperatures, below the spinlass transition temperature, another characteristic feature of spinlasses is that it gets very the dynamics gets very slow and the system drops out of equilibrium. And there have been quite a lot of experimental work, again pioneered by the Uppsala group, to characterize in a quantitative way the non-equilibrium behavior. The system is not really in equilibrium. And as a result, you measure some quantity and it changes with time. So this is just one particular example from the Uppsala group. And there's a lot on this figure, so let's just look at one of these curves. This is, by the way, the imaginary part of the AC susceptibility for a particular spin mass, which I'm afraid I don't remember. And this temperature of 17 Kelvin is a little bit below where you get the cusp in the susceptibility, which is more like 21, 22. So we've just gone down into the spin mass phase. So we've gone into the spin mass phase, and we monitor the AC susceptibility as a function of time. Now, of course, if the system were in equilibrium, the signal would be independent of time. That's what you mean by equilibrium. But clearly it is not. So just for the sake of argument, let's look at this bottom curve here, which is at 0.17 hertz, again, a very low frequency. And you see a gradual drift with time, with the signal, indicating that the longer you wait, the longer you age the system, it's still, the behavior is changing, it's still evolving towards equilibrium without ever actually getting there. So ultimately, a theory of spin masses needs to explain the non-equilibrium dynamics below TC. And as we shall see, that we still have some way to go in doing that. One of the most spectacular results of these aging type measurements leads to effects which are called rejuvenation and memory. So I would like to just explain what that is. This is a insulating Heisenberg spin mass. So this is yet another type of system, but with very similar behavior. Imaginary part of the AC susceptibility at a frequency 0.04 hertz. Right? So these are really low frequencies. And what is shown here, first of all, by the solid line, which they call the reference curve, you just gradually cool down. And you get the peak of more or less a cusp, and you gradually cool down, and you get some fairly smooth behavior. Then the open diamonds, where it says decreasing T, you do the same thing until you get to this point here, and then you wait or age the system at 12 degrees Kelvin. And as you saw in the previous transparency, the signal gradually drifts with time till it gets to here, and then you start to cool again. And the first thing you see is the data hops back pretty quickly to the reference curve, the solid line. So that indicates that the time you spent at waiting at 12 didn't really do any help you at all to equilibrate at significantly lower temperatures. It's as if the system has to start aging again or gets rejuvenated when you go to a lower temperature. So this hop back up to the reference curve is called rejuvenation. And then when you warm back now, this is the increasing T curve, the solid circles, you go continuously up in temperature at a smooth rate. You do not wait on the way up at 12 Kelvin, but nonetheless you still get a dip in the signal at 12 Kelvin without having to wait. Because the system has obviously remembered that you cooled, that you waited at 12 Kelvin on the way down. There's some imprint preserved in the spin configurations when you low temperatures, and that is remembered when you go back up. Yes?
So when you go down and wait at 12, and then you go up and then wait at 8, you still get another dip?
Yes, actually the same paper showed another curve where you waited at two temperatures on the way down and on the way back up. Both memories were found, dips at the two temperatures. So you can imprint memories at more than one temperature. So this is these non-equilibrium aspects are quite an area of activity theoretically at the moment, and I think they're less well understood than the equilibrium behavior in the vicinity of the transition. And I will, if I have time at the end, explain why I think that's it's more difficult to sort this out. So that's the experimental behavior. What model can we use to do theoretical calculations? Well, since we argue that there's a lot of universality, what we should do is take the simplest model with the basic physics ingredients, randomness and frustration. And the model everyone takes was first proposed by Edwards and Anderson in 1975. And you, for simplicity, you put your spins down on a regular lattice, say a square lattice, simple cubic lattice. You have interactions between them, Jij, which in the simplest case might just be between nearest neighbor interactions. And you make it a spin mass by having these interactions random, and you make the different interactions statistically independent random variables chosen from some probability distribution P of Jij. And you want to get a spin mass without being biased towards ferromagnetism on the one hand or antiferromagnetism on the other hand. So you would typically make this a symmetric distribution to avoid any bias towards ferro or antiferromagnetism, which could give you some additional corrections to scaling. And Gaussian distribution is often taken, a bimodal distribution plus or minus one is quite often taken too, and one argues the details shouldn't matter. This should explain much of the experimental data. So what is predicted is, by Edwards Anderson, is that there is indeed a phase transition in these in this model. They did a sort of mean field theory, which I'll come back to in a minute. And the Edwards Anderson order parameter takes account of the fact that when you get this phase transition, the spins don't freeze in some regular periodic structure like all up, which would be ferromagnetism, or alternately up or down, which would be antiferromagnetism. They order in some pretty random looking way, but which this random ordering is of course very strongly connected with the particular configurations of plus or minus interactions, and it's choosing the particular orientation of the spins in order to minimize the free energy. So some of the spins will get frozen up, some will get frozen down, if this is an Ising in some random way, and to allow for the fact that some of the spins will be pointing up, some will be pointing down in some random way, we don't just take the thermal average of a spin to be the order parameter, that would be the magnetization, that would be zero because this is not a ferromagnet, so we take the square of this thermal average, and then in the theory of disordered systems, we have to average over the disorder. There's always two averages we have to do, so I'll indicate that by this second. If we look at what is happening then, we can find response function called the spin mass susceptibility, which will diverge. If I look at the spin-spin correlation function, the idea will be there is a correlation length in this spin mass which is going to diverge. But I don't see it in just the spin-spin correlation function for the similar sort of reasons as above. Some of the spins a given distance apart will be ferromagnetically correlated, and others the same distance apart will be anti-ferromagnetically correlated. So I need, as always in spin masses, to take the square of everything. So I take the square of this spin-spin correlation function. So in effect, it is a four-spin object that I would expect that this would diverge as I approach the spin glass transition temperature, because for a given spin I, more and more sites J are going to contribute as this correlation length grows, and this would diverge with some, presumably some power law and some exponent. Now, what I mentioned was
Yes. Is gamma supposed to be the same one which shows up in the measurement of the nonlinear?
Exactly. That's what we're coming to. So this is essentially the same, actually, as the nonlinear susceptibility, which is the fourth derivative of the free energy with respect to an external magnetic field. So it's, if you figure out what that gives, it's some four-spin cumulant average that you have to take. And part of the four-spin cumulant average is the square of a two-spin piece. And one can argue, particularly for a symmetric distribution, that this is essentially all that remains, actually, by the time you've averaged over the disorder. So this is essentially the same as the spin mass susceptibility. And this is quite important. This is why we have this divergent quantity that you can measure experimentally, which tells you there is a spin glass phase transition. So this is quite important. So the mean field theory then.
What's the history of that? When did people first emphasize this?
Nonlinear susceptibility, divergent. Well, I think pretty soon after, for example, the mean field theory, the Edward Anderson and then, as I'm going to mention, Sherrington and Kirkpatrick papers came out, you could see that the nonlinear susceptibility diverged in the mean field theory. So that was around about 75, 76.
Your thermal average and your disorder average can be taken whichever way you like.
Well, the thermal average is squared here, so I think that you have to make sure that you're doing this thermal average squared. So I think you have to do this first. So the mean field theory was generally taken following Sherrington and Kirkpatrick to be the exact solution of a rather artificial model which they propose, so-called SK model, in which the range of the interactions here, this JIJ, is infinite. So everything interacts with everything else. Of course, that's not very physical. But the point is that for ferromagnetism, which we understand much better, the mean field approximation, which is in many respects quite a good approximation, becomes exact for an artificial model in which the range of the interactions diverges. So basically, Sherrington and Kirkpatrick turned that argument around and said, let's call the mean field theory of spin masses, which otherwise it wasn't so obvious what that was, to be the exact solution of an infinite range model, and try to solve that, and then hope that real systems in three dimensions with short-range interactions would have rather similar behavior. And that last bit, of course, as many of you know, has been quite controversial, and I may get a little bit to that right at the end, depending on how time goes. It's going slowly, I guess, at the moment. So anyway, in the mean field theory, there is a transition temperature, T equals TC, at which the nonlinear susceptibility diverges. There is a mean field critical exponent, which is equal to 1, quite different from the experimental value, which is much bigger. So that already might indicate that fluctuation effects are very important. And a lot of difficulty arose to try to solve even this infinite range model below TC. And after a lot of work, the solution that was eventually proposed by Parisi, a very complicated solution, has become established, generally believed to be the exact solution. And in fact, there is a claim recently by a French mathematician to prove rigorously that the Parisi free energy, at least, is the exact free energy. So this is complicated because the configuration space in the infinite range model breaks up into many valleys with presumably infinite barriers between them. So in particular, if you look at the order parameter a little more carefully, what we will do also in the simulations to calculate this thermal average squared is to take two copies of the system, copy one, copy two, this is copy one, this is copy two, same interactions but the spins are fluctuating differently, and we can define an instantaneous order parameter, which I'll call big Q, to be if you want the overlap between the spin in replica one with the spins in replica two. And if I then take the average of that, this is the order parameter that I wrote down before. And the situation is complicated in the mean field theory because the order parameter is not just a single number, but is characterized by a whole distribution with a peak at some Edwards-Anderson order parameter, but also a continuous part of this distribution extending even down to zero overlap. So these peaks are due to the situation where the two copies are in the same valley. And this is the overlap of spins in a given valley.
These two peaks represent the two replicas.
One, these two peaks represent the overlap of the spin configuration between the two replicas. The peak at positive Q is where they're in the same valley. The peak at negative Q is where one is in that valley we talked about and the other is in the valley which has the same energy in zero field with all the spins reversed. So if you applied a small field to break the symmetry, you would suppress the negative part. And this bit in between comes from the probability that one copy is in one valley and another copy is in a completely different valley and they have a smaller overlap with each other. And what's striking is that at least in the mean field theory there is some significant statistical weight, remember this is an equilibrium, where those two spin configurations have no overlap with each other. So to get from one configuration to the other you turn over half the spins. And yet both those configurations have significant statistical weight, which is quite a surprising conclusion.
There's nothing on the other side of the peak?
No, I mean the maximum value would be 1.
Right.
In a finite system, in simulations, these peaks get rounded out. But in the infinite system size, there's a delta function here with nothing beyond.
But as you go down in temperature, what happens?
Yeah, so if you go down in temperature, the position of these peaks moves towards 1, because the system gets pretty ordered in a given valley. And the amplitude of the this, let me call this the tail in the distribution, goes down as you reduce the temperature. And I guess it's proportional to T at low temperatures.
The weight in the tail,
that's right.
So at zero temperature.
At zero temperature, there is a unique ground state. But at any finite temperature, the system can be in different valleys with relatively small overlap with each other, but with some finite statistical weight. And there is one more rather striking prediction of the.
Yeah, but that's, that means that the free energy barriers between these different states is infinite, but the energy difference
is about a 1.
The total
free energy difference is about a 1.
The total free energy.
Right, which is quite surprising. Another surprising feature is if you apply a magnetic field, H, then before we were talking about a transition in zero net applied field, but if you apply a magnetic field, you might have naively thought that that would round out the transition, just as it does for a ferromagnet. But at least in mean field theory, it doesn't exactly do that. There is still a phase transition in a magnetic field, the so-called Almeida-Thouless, or AT line, which separates a region where the configuration space is quite simple, a paramagnetic system. There's a spectrum of relaxation times, but which doesn't go to infinity, it terminates at some finite value. And then there is a spinless phase with these infinite relaxation times and different valleys with barriers between them, which, as Matthew said, diverge, and this complicated order parameter distribution. So this is actually a very striking prediction, because it says we can have a transition from a sort of ergodic to non-ergodic phase transition without there being any change in symmetry. So this is quite striking too.
You never said anything about the thermodynamic signature of this. I mean, is there an anomaly in specific heat?
Right. In the mean field theory, there is a cusp in the specific heat. Just something like this. Experimentally, you see essentially nothing in the specific heat. And that's compatible with simulations where if you get critical exponents, to estimate the specific heat exponent from scaling, you find that it's large and negative in the simulation. So you would see not only would the specific heat be continuous, but the derivative of the specific heat with respect to temperature would be continuous, and then it's really tough to see anything. So that was a good comment. So this Almeida-Thouless line is a striking prediction, and it's my view, and I may have this time towards the end mentioned that this is an artifact of the infinite range interactions, and that this does not occur in a finite system. There would be no transition, in my opinion, in a finite range system. Okay. So this is the mean field theory. What do we know about more realistic systems with short range interactions? So most of what we know has come from numerical simulations. So we've already said that an important concept is that this is a real phase transition with a correlation length, psi, which diverges as you approach the transition temperature, with some critical exponent mu. And I think that everybody is pretty much in agreement that if you look in two dimensions, the spin mass transition is only at zero temperature. And there are some experimental work on thin films which seem to be consistent with that. So there is a sort of transition at zero temperature where the correlation length will diverge, and you can get estimate that critical exponent nu, say for an Ising spinglass and a Heisenberg spinglass. For both those cases, the prediction is that the transition only occurs at zero temperature. Now, for three dimensions, most of the work was done historically for the Ising spinglass, because that's the simplest to do numerically. Now, here we go. And so I'll mention the results first. Of course, you know that you can only study rather small finite system sizes on the computer doing, say, Monte Carlo simulations. And that problem of small sizes is particularly acute for a spring mass because, as we've said in the experiments, the dynamics gets very slow. Well, it does in the simulations too. And there are some tricks we do called parallel tempering to try to speed things up a bit, but it only helps a bit. It's not a panacea, and I don't think I want to go into that. So we have to try to extrapolate results on finite systems and pretty small systems, for which of course any transition is rounded out, extrapolate to the infinite system size, because it's only there that you get a phase transition. So the techniques for doing that are called finite size scaling, and one quantity that's particularly useful to do finite size scaling on is the correlation length, the spin mass correlation length itself. Now the spin mass correlation length in an infinite system diverges at the critical point, but we don't have an infinite system, we have a box of size L. So presumably the correlation length gets up to a size of order L at the critical point, but doesn't diverge. So if we calculate the spin mass correlation length in our box, which we do by looking at these spin-glass correlation functions, Fourier transforming it and extracting a length out of that, and divide by the size of the box, we expect that at the critical point this is just some number independent of L. And if we're away from the critical point, we expect it can be represented by some scaling function. Now, what the basic argument of the finite size scaling is, what matters is the ratio of the size of the system to the bulk correlation length. And the 1 over the bulk correlation length goes like t minus tc to the power nu. So this is the basic hypothesis. And it's simpler to take this variable to the power 1 over nu so that t minus tc comes in linearly and you can go right through the phase transition. That's what you want, because you know in a finite system there really is no singularity at the critical point. So I take this to the power 1 over nu, and this is how we expect the behavior to occur. And so if we plot this as a function of temperature for different sizes, then at the critical temperature, the data should be independent of size. So if this is, for example, what I get for a small size L, and this is what I get for an intermediate size, and this is what I get for a bigger size, then at least as long as corrections to this finite size scaling are small, the data should intersect at the transition temperature. So the nice thing about this quantity is you see by R, really, whether there's a transition or not. You don't need to do some complicated multi-parameter fit to see whether it fits best with TC0 or TC non-zero. So you should have some plot of some data for that, which is actually not yet published. I mean, this data has been around for a while. I'm showing you some unpublished data of an ex-student of mine, Helmut Katzgraber. And this is a fairly blown up region near where we estimate the transition temperature to be. This is for an Ising spin mass in three dimensions where the interactions are plus one or minus one with equal probability. And we're looking for intersections, and you see pretty nice evidence for intersections at around what temperature of 1.12. This data is for sizes between 6 and 24. If I'd plotted data for smaller sizes than that, you would have seen that the intersections were not so nice, indicating corrections to finite size scaling if L is very small. But for this range of sizes, this intersection of the data looks pretty good. And we actually work quite hard to do this range of sizes, although in many fields up to 24 cubed would be considered pretty poor. For a spin mass, it's considered actually fairly respectable. And in order to get the error bars down, we had to average over a very large number of samples, maybe 10,000 samples or something. That's a bit less for the larger sizes, because for a finite system, there are sample-to-sample fluctuations, and therefore we need to do an average over a large number of samples.
How much computer time left thought?
Yeah, that was done at the big multiprocessor system at the ETH Zurich, so it's probably a few processor years, but I couldn't tell you exactly what few means. So this, I would claim, is pretty good evidence for a finite temperature spin mass transition. And this, other people actually got the data earlier, which in using the same quantity, a Spanish group, Ballesteros et al., were the first to do that. And I think when you saw their paper, you had to believe that it was a finite temperature spin mass transition, at least for an Ising system. However, there were still some issues, and in particular, that data was for the Ising spin mass, because that's easier to beat to death numerically, and it was much harder, it had been much harder to find evidence for a spin mass transition for a Heisenberg spin mass. And yet that's pretty important, because you know, that system like copper manganese, which I showed you, surely that's to a first approximation a Heisenberg model with rather weak anisotropy. And however, it was difficult, and we'll come to find evidence for a finite transition temperature for the Heisenberg spin mass. And because of that, a Japanese physicist called Kawamura proposed the idea that there is no spin mass transition in an isotropic Heisenberg spin mass, but there is a different sort of transition. Well, it's not the spins that are having some sort of glassy freezing, but the chiralities, that is to say the local vorticities, are having some glassy type freezing. So, you know that because of the disorder and frustration, if I have a Heisenberg spin mass, the ground state doesn't have spins in a collinear manner. Clearly it will relieve the frustration by splaying out in different directions. So even at zero temperature, if you sort of go around a square, you can the sum of local chirality or vorticity quenched in at zero temperature.
You're talking about something like S dot, S cross S, that kind of thing?
Yes, so for the Heisenberg model, the definition used was exactly that, a triple scalar product of three adjacent spins in that, say, in a line or around the corner of a square, exactly. And for an XY spin mass, you could define it in terms of the angles as you go around an elementary square. So the idea is that at low temperatures, the relative spin orientations here are fixed, and the relative spin orientations here are fixed, but in the Kawamura scenario, these can rotate relative to these. So there's only a finite spin mass correlation length. But the chirality here is that if I rotate the spins, the chirality doesn't change. That triple scalar product stays the same. So you could, in principle, have what he calls a decoupling of spins and chiralities, where a chiral glass correlation length could diverge, while a spin glass correlation length stayed finite. In which case, to explain the experiment, you would have to incorporate the bit of weak anisotropy, which of course any real system actually has, and that would couple the spins and chirality. So in this picture, the chiralities are the driving force. They're having this transition, and at sort of at the last minute, the weak anisotropy pulls the spins along and gives you a divergence in the nonlinear susceptibility. However, one of the things I was involved in recently was to do these finite size scaling type calculations for the correlation length, and looking at the correlation length of the spins and the correlation length of the chiralities, and seeing if there's evidence that one diverges without the other diverging. And if I know that if you directly look at the correlation length, that's not what you see. You see that good evidence for a transition in both at about the same temperature, presumably exactly the same temperature.
In the XY case,
yeah.
Did he suggest that? Yeah, was that plausible in the XY case? I guess I...
Well, I think it conceivably it could happen that there could be this, no, the decoupling of spins and chiralities on large scales, and that the chiral glass correlation length could diverge in principle without the spin glass correlation length diverging. The converse could not be true, but I'm not aware that you can rigorously rule it out, but I mean, we claim we ruled it out from simulation, yeah, so maybe there is some reason why it can't.
In terms of happen. Vortex lines,
mm-hmm.
So you're saying,
Peter, you ruled out for Heisenberg or XY?
Both. We did simulations for both. And the data looked pretty much like what I just showed you, not quite as nice, but not bad, both for the spins and the chiralities. Transition temperature was very low. So fluctuations are more important for Heisenberg than Ising, and that was one of the reasons why this transition was not seen for Heisenberg before. In the old days, we didn't have these parallel tempering techniques which help us go down to lower temperatures. You got a question?
For this Heisenberg spin, if you define chirality, does that involve six spin?
Yeah. 3, S1 dot S2 cross S3.
Yes, three spins. Oh. We use this spin glass.
Right. So each of these spins will be replaced by 3 to get a corresponding susceptibility that would diverge. So it would be some 12 spin object, actually. Some 12th derivative of the free energy with respect to an external field.
Say this TC equals 0 and 3D
Ising,
I mean?
3D Ising TC is finite.
And for XY and Heisenberg, you also think it's all.
Yes, I also think the Heisenberg and XY finite TC in 3 dimensions and 0 in 2 dimensions.
Because experimentally, any single actor center isotropy would ultimately be in 2 dimensions.
That's right, yes. So the question is, the point is that in some systems the anisotropy is weak, and the question is it still essential to get the transition, that weak anisotropy? And we claim no.
Would you expect some sort of crossover effects being related to the relative size or the importance of the anisotropy to the interactions and exchange interactions?
Yes, that's right. I think that particularly in the scenario where TC is zero in the Heisenberg case, you should expect quite significant crossover effects for systems with weak anisotropy. For our scenario where TC is finite anyway, then there could be crossover between one set of exponents for Heisenberg and another set of exponents for Ising, but those exponents are hard to determine with great precision at both experimentally and the simulations, and may not be all that different from each other anyway. Well, maybe I need to be try and be fairly brief. So for the Almeida Thallus line transition in a field, there is also a length scale which diverges in the mean field type picture as you go across this Almeida Thallus line. The problem is, it turns out it's not the spin glass it's not the nonlinear susceptibility anymore. So this connection between a spin glass susceptibility, which is like this but modified to include the fact that in a magnetic field the expectation value of a spin is non-zero, this diverges on the AT line, and there's a correlation length corresponding to that diverges, but that is not the non-linear susceptibility, unfortunately. The non-linear susceptibility doesn't do anything. And so the attempts to find the Almeida Thallus line experimentally use the other technique which I mentioned earlier on. You look at the cusp, the temperature of the cusp for different frequencies, and say, try to extrapolate down to zero frequency, does the cusp temperature go to zero? And careful measurements by the Uppsala group concluded, yes, it does tend to zero when omega tends to zero. So no, that would be no Almeida Thallus line according to these experiments. Now, one of the useful things about simulations is you can really go in there and see exactly what all the spins are doing and calculate things that can't be calculated in experiment. So we can actually calculate this thing which does diverge along the Almeida Thallus line, if one exists, and the corresponding correlation length. And what we find is as soon as we put on a magnetic field, instead of getting these really pretty intersections, which you saw on the overhead before, no intersections at all. It seems that the transition is wiped out when you apply a magnetic field. There may be some sort of crossover, but the AT line does not seem to occur in three dimensions. And my prejudice is it probably doesn't occur in any dimension and is more likely to be an artifact of the infinite range interaction. So let me just say...
Does the absence of the AT line say anything about the absence or presence of the weight in P of Q away from the two peaks?
Well, that's a good question. I think they're separate, issues. I think so. That's sort of related to what I was going to mention briefly next, and this will be the last part. And that is attempts to describe the nature of the spin last state that you get below TC. And two phenomenological pictures have been proposed. One assumes that the solution of the infinite range model of Parisi goes through essentially the same for short range interactions. In particular, there will be an AT line, there will be a non-trivial order parameter distribution. And the, so this is Parisi. And the other approach looks at sort of the geometrical nature of the low energy excitations in the system, which are called droplets, and so this is often referred to as the droplet picture. And this was worked out in detail by Daniel Fisher and David Hughes, and there were similar ideas actually due to Bill McMillan and Moore, Bray and Moore. And in the droplet picture, there is no Almeida Thallus line. There is just a single, or in zero field, a pair of thermodynamic states. So that in the, if you look at this order parameter distribution, this weight in the middle, that came from having many different thermodynamic states with different overlaps. This, in an infinite system, is not present in the droplet theory. The droplet theory would just give you, the order parameter would just be a single number, which I'm calling QEA here, where the delta function is. Of course, everything is rounded out in a finite system. So when you do simulations, these peaks will be rounded out, and to some extent, there will be some weight in the middle, too, from fluctuations. But in the droplet picture, this weight in the middle here would go to zero with some inverse power of the system size. And there's some critical or exponent characteristic of the zero temperature fixed point, theta, according to which this weight would go to zero. So this, what's confusing is the simulations seem to be somewhat in between the RSB and the droplet picture. Because the fact that we claim there's no Almeida Thallus line, that's like the droplet picture. But in the simulations, we actually find this non-trivial distribution with the amount of this piece in the tail not changing over the range of system sizes that we can study, which is admittedly pretty small, and up to maybe 12 cubed
What's theta? I mean, this is the I thing.
Right, so this is the I thing. So in three dimensions, theta is expected to be about 0.2.
Pretty small.
Oh, it's pretty small, all right. So, I mean, the effect is predicted is bigger than the error bars in the simulation, but there could be systematic effects. So it could well be that you go to larger sizes and you'd see the droplet picture. Since you mentioned it, though, one of the things we did was to take a one-dimensional model with long-range interactions that fall off with a power law, so you can have a finite TC. The total number of spins you can study is about the same, but instead of being 8 cubed with L equals 8, it's L equals 512. So we can choose parameters where there's a finite TC, go below TC, do this, and up to L equals 512 in this one-dimensional model, it also doesn't change the weight in this tail here.
And RS being droplet,
I mean,
the droplet picture is not modified in the long-range interactions?
Well, not according to a paper of Fisher and Hughes. But maybe that needs to be thought out. So maybe there are some subtleties for long-range interactions. In fact, this is pretty theoretical, actually, because no real experimental system is truly in equilibrium below TC, and all this is talking about equilibrium. What presumably happens is if you quench the system below TC, locally things can come to some sort of equilibrium, because locally the fluctuations only have to go over finite energy barriers. So people typically talk about a sort of dynamical correlation length, which depends on temperature and time, and is slowly growing as a function of time. So if you have a sort of simple picture where you say the time to go over some barrier whose energy is delta E would be some Arrhenius type expression like this, and if we say, well, if we want to flip over a droplet of spins of length scale L, how does the energy barrier to do that vary with L? Well, you might make an ansatz that varies with a power of L, where psi would be called a barrier exponent. And so we're going to, on a particular time scale T, we're going to equate the correlation length with this length scale here. Fluctuations up to that scale can occur and presumably locally equilibrate the system. So that would tell you that, at least in this picture, that this dynamical correlation length slowly grows with time, and only logarithmically in this picture. So, if it's true that to see the droplet picture you have to go to some huge length scale, it's maybe not that relevant experimentally, since you can only, even on experimental timescales, go up to some fairly moderate situation for the system to be equilibrated. So the goal, obviously, then, is to understand the non-equilibrium behavior below TC. And this is only partially understood, and one of the difficulties is there's a big difference in timescales between what is studied experimentally and what is studied in the simulations. So in experiment, there will be some microscopic timescale, which will be, well, let's say, something like 10 to the minus 12 seconds. And you saw that some of the experiments were done for maybe a few hours. So maybe you can have a time of, say, 10 to the 4 seconds, which is 10 to the 16 in units of the microscopic time. That's quite a few powers of 10 there. And in the simulations, T0 is one Monte Carlo sweep, presumably. And maybe you can do, well, you can perhaps do a little better, let's say 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 sweeps. And so you've got about 10 powers of 10 shorter time in the simulations than in the experiments. And in the simulations, it's not yet been possible, for example, to reproduce this dip in those experimental curves I showed you, at least not in anything like a sharp way. And I think this is, so people worry, is this because the Edwards-Anderson model is no good, which I find a bit doubtful, or what else could it be? Well, what else could it be is that this big separation in timescales between the experiment and the simulations. And I think this is part of the reason why these non-equilibrium phenomena have been rather hard to reproduce in the simulations. And not related to that is the fact that in experiments, when they say, well, we go to temperature T1, we quench the system to temperature T1, say, this doesn't happen instantaneously in the experiment. It may happen over, a few seconds? But that's 10 to the 12 times the microscopic time. That is itself longer than any simulation we could hope to do. So the fact that the cooling rate is actually quite slow on any sort of scale of the simulation is another difference.
Would you see, in the simulations, can you see any signatures?
Yes.
Yes. Something.
That's right. And there's, you can see some effects of memory. Actually, not too difficult. What memory is telling you, if you go to lower temperatures, the fluctuations at that on the length scale of that higher temperature are totally frozen out. So nothing is happening on that large length scale appropriate for the higher temperatures. When you come back, you can sort of take over from where you left off. Rejuvenation turns out to be a little harder to get. Why should? So it's difficult to be sure what's going on because you have this big separation of timescales. But I think that there are possibilities to be sort of systematic and see if one can systematically go to experimental behavior by changing the length of the simulation.
No one's addressed this in the mean
field.
No one's addressed this in the mean field picture.
Yes, there have been studies in mean field theory, but mainly in a different context, actually. Because you're not in equilibrium, the fluctuation dissipation theorem is violated. And at least in the mean field theory, it's violated, so you could say there's absolutely no relation, maybe, between the time-dependent response function and whatever it is, the derivative, time derivative of the correlation function. But actually, it seems that there is some relationship, but instead of the difference between those two being the factor of the temperature, there's some effective temperature. And what effective temperature? Well, that's claimed to be related to this Parisi order parameter function in some way. But for memory and rejuvenation, that hasn't really much been looked at in the mean field theory, mainly this violation of the fluctuation dissipation thing.
So if you have another insulator that conductor, do people have studied the effect on the resistivity or
this
experiment? Depending on the potential disorder, or whether they don't know, I'm just asking.
Yeah, I think that has been done, and I don't think there's much happening in the resistivity. Surely the scattering off these local moments in the manganese, and then I don't think there's a dramatic effect seen when you go through this critical temperature. So you're talking about the critical behavior or the zero temperature?
There's no critical behavior in the resistivity, it's just
right. Okay, yeah.
You have some typical experiments, what are they?
You mean for the zero temperature limit?
Processes, yeah.
I don't remember, I'm afraid. I'm not sure.
The dynamics, you would think, would change, right? Because you have damping.
Sure, so it should affect the...
Right, but the spin mass physics is going on really long time scales, and it's not obvious that that's particularly relevant for scattering of electrons, which... But I'm not sure, maybe... So I guess I'm pretty sure there's nothing happening at the critical point. At zero temperature, that, yeah, I'm sure that that has been studied, and I just don't remember the results, I'm afraid. Yeah.
So how much spin glass apart from copper manganese do you look for in other systems, like cuprates or...
Sorry, I didn't quite understand the question.
Is it the spin glass physics which is going on in all this complicated material?
Oh, you mean like the cuprates and the heavy fermions and so on? Well, I thought that by giving this talk I could get the audience to know more about cuprates and heavy fermions than me to answer that question. I'm not sure. I mean, I've not really seen good data for, say, the non-linear susceptibility in the cuprates, which would indicate a spin glass phase transition. Now, maybe that exists, but that would be really interesting to look for if it's experimentally feasible.
Yeah, I think the only thing about cuprates, right, is that USR.
And USR shows that the dynamics slows down below whatever it is, 10 to the minus 7 seconds, but that's pretty fast on the time scale of spin glasses.
Yeah,
what about specific heat? Again, the same question about transport. Do you have some specific experiments?
Right, so at low temperatures, the specific heat varies at least roughly linear in T. And one could... the specific heat, yes. And it's plausible that you can get a linear specific heat out of sort of low energy excitations, a bit like two-level systems maybe in structural gases. But anyway, some distribution of low energy excited states, if you have a constant density of those states, you could get a linear specific heat. So the specific heat is roughly linear, but I think there's been some discussion as to whether it's really linear or whether there's some power slightly different from one.
I could comment on that. I mean, it's been slightly superlinear, and we did some experiment many years ago on some anisotropic spin glasses, and we found some sort of relation between the strength of the deviation from the from linearity with the strength of the anisotropy. So anisotropic systems tend to be superlinear.
So the power is bigger than
one.
This is for insulators.
Yeah.
This would be insulating, but Ising type. Yes.
What's the time dependence of the susceptibility you showed us? Is it strictly exponential? Is it similar to glassy behavior, like normal glasses?
Ah, yes. My understanding is that people have tried to fit it to logarithmic behavior and power law behavior. I don't think stretched exponential fits so well. I think logarithmic...
It's slower than that.
I think it's slower than that, yeah. So power law or some logarithmic behavior. Seeing what people have generally...
So that means it's more quantum dominated, because classically you would expect it's activated behavior and there's some complicated energy landscape and then you get this
quench
disorder, right. So
the configuration of glasses and window pane, is that, because here there's quench disorder, is that really...
Yeah.
And if there's actually here, there's equilibrium phase transition, so things, and if there may not be in window pane,
right.
In which case things can get slower.
But I think, actually, so if you consider that activation of the barriers is taking place due to the quench disorder, I think some sort of logarithmic variation with time is something that's quite plausible, if you think it's barrier activation. And that the height of the barriers is increasing with some power of the size of the region that's being flipped. So my understanding is that the data is actually, although it's maybe slower than stretched exponential, generally is faster than this. And it's been hard to understand why. In fact, it's not just going logarithmic with time. Maybe this would happen at really long times. But it seems to go more like a power law in many cases than the logarithm. But
what is the expectation for the psi? It's probably pretty small too, right?
Well, there's not too much known, actually. And it's hard in numerics to figure out what psi is. And there are experimental values where people do various tricks, you know, change magnetic fields and do this, that, and the other. And it seems to me those estimates are rather all over the place. I don't know whether I'm treading on any toes here. So I don't think psi is well characterized, either in experiments or in simulations.
Now for the Parisi picture, you would expect it, wouldn't you expect it to be zero actually?
No. The picture we have is that there's some complicated landscape with some barrier here between the valleys, which will, in the Parisi picture, presumably diverge in the thermodynamic limit. But this, the fact you get this non-trivial distribution, that refers to the free energies of the minima of the bottoms of the valleys, and that has to be just a number of order one, not of order the size of the system. Whereas the barrier presumably diverges with some power of the size of the system. Okay, well, I guess that's it. Thanks for your attention.